Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstead in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories about the people who work there.
This week on campus, we are noticing all of the end-of-year awards ceremonies that are happening. First, there are multiple graduation ceremonies, which honor our students and their achievements. I personally really love the smaller departmental graduations where we can see and recognize individual students and also meet their parents. They're really a highlight of my semester, and I always tear up when I hear pomp and circumstance and watch the students walk down the aisle.
Yeah, me too, Lisa. And even on Zoom, I think that the small ones are really moving. And celebrating students just doesn't get old. You know, completing college is such a huge accomplishment, and it's great to take time to just appreciate that fact and mark students' big transition to life after college. But there are a lot of other kinds of end-of-the-year recognition ceremonies happening on campuses, and it seems like I'm getting notices every day about an award ceremony coming up for faculty, staff, or administrators, and no students will be in attendance. So, for example, there's one that I'm going to in a couple weeks. There are about 23 people being honored for things like the Extra Mile Award. I don't know what that is. Yeah, maybe I'll find out what that is. I'll let you know. The Excellence in International Activities Award, one Leadership Award, not sure what that means either. There are multiple Research Excellence Awards, Teaching Excellence Awards, Staff Recognition Awards, an Advising Award, and that's not even all of them. There's more.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I don't mean to be like cranky and cynical here, but it seems to me like it might not be a coincidence that all of these ceremonies and celebrations of people are coming at the very same time that universities continue to cut back on raises, leaves, and research budgets.
Yeah, I know, right? And let me say here, I am delighted to have a job. But right after the email updating us on the furlough for spring, there's an email asking me to serve on one of the many awards committees to judge who gets these. So, you know, and also our department feels like we have to put people up for these awards so that our department is recognized so we won't get cut so bad next time there's a big round of cuts. So I also write a bunch of award nominations every year. So more work, less pay, but you do get those paper certificates that you can, you know, like, well, you know, what do you do with those? I'm really not sure.
You frame them, you like plaster them up on your office. I don't know. I mean, the contradiction is really the sharpest for me with the diversity, equity, and inclusion awards. It's like we talked about last week with the land acknowledgements. If all we're doing is acknowledging good things and we're not actually supporting them with resources, then it seems pretty hollow.
Bingo, Lisa. And this week, our interview shines a spotlight on people who do critical work on campus that often don't get spotlighted or fairly compensated.
I spoke with Tracy Harder, a member of the housekeeping staff at UNC Chapel Hill. Tracy has been cleaning the dorms at UNC for 14 years. She's a diehard Tar Heels fan and a member of UE 150, the North Carolina Service Workers Union. I first encountered Tracy last summer in the midst of the first wave of COVID and the national shortages of PPE. She and her union publicized the university's failures to protect the health and safety of the staff. And they gained some really important media coverage that helped push the UNC administration to change course. So let's listen to my interview. Tracy Harder, welcome to College Land.
Thank you, Miss Lisa. Glad to be here.
You work Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. And I've heard that Mondays are the hardest days of the week for you and your coworkers. Can you tell us a little bit about why that's the case?
Because we have weekend workers that come in and do minimalistic things to stay on top of things. But the overall cleaning and sanitizing is not done on Saturday and Sunday. So we're just we come in Monday and we just get things up to good standard. And whenever possible, you know, we can do some detailed cleaning. So that's basically the reason, just making up for Saturday and Sunday.
And these are in the dormitories at UNC. What is the kind of work that you and your team are doing?
Well, from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, we do what we call morning work. We're not allowed to be going down the hallways to the restrooms and the like. So we just do the common areas like kitchens, laundry rooms, lounges, that type of thing. And we go in, we get everything wiped down, clean up any messes, sweep, mop, take out trash, put furniture back in place, just bring things back up to working standard. And we got high standard.
And then at 9 o'clock, what happens? I assume that 7 to 9, the idea is that the students need to sleep and that you don't want to wake them up. And so then at 9 o'clock, there's a shift.
Well, at 9 o'clock, from 9 to 9:15, we have our first break. That's when everybody just sits and maybe has a little morning snack and maybe some morning coffee to wake us up the rest of the way. And that's pretty much it. And then after that is when we go to tackle the areas that the students are in, the showers and the restrooms, you know, just everything.
So if you're cleaning the dorms, you're in the bathrooms, you're in the showers, that means you're in frequent contact, I assume, with the students who live in the dorms. Can you talk a little bit about what that's like?
Well, before the pandemic, it was, you know, just for me, it's awesome. I love talking to the kids and them talking to me and having conversations about just everything. Yet there's just never anything off the table. And they're the most exciting part of the job. So I enjoy it very much. Now with the pandemic, for me, there's still that element there, but we all still have a respectable caution that we use.
What kinds of things would you all talk about?
We've talked about girlfriend-boyfriend issues, issues with professors, what they're going to be doing with their education, encouraging them for exams, like the midterm exams. I always try to pass some different ways to look at it, you know, such as that the good thing about midterms is it's a map for you. It shows you your strengths and your weaknesses. So when you go do your finals, that really makes the difference. Then you'll know where you need to concentrate on and put more effort in so that your finals will turn out better. And, you know, just a lot of things, even politics. We have some really great conversations about politics and religion. You name it, it's on the table. We talk.
So I often think about housekeepers getting stuck cleaning up after some kind of gross things that young adults can engage in. And I'm thinking about you coming in on a Monday morning after a weekend on UNC campus. And, you know, I live near that campus, so I have some sense of what goes on there on weekends. I mean, is that a thing?
Well, for me personally, my dorm is like blessed or something, because I honestly rarely run into any of the problems that some housekeepers run into. But yeah, you do run into it. Sometimes, you know, you have to clean up where somebody has thrown up. It doesn't necessarily mean they drank too much. They might have the flu or something. There's a lot of reasons why that happens. And there's, you know, other things that we run into, but that's part of the job. Although when I was in Carmichael, we used to call that one the beast. I used to work in there. Yeah, we had some really crazy stuff in there. We had some boys we called the hairy boys, and they went into the restroom with those clippers that give you buzz haircuts, mm-hmm. and they must all got buzz haircuts because there's a lot of hair in there. They even took scissors and cut the cord of the clippers and left part of the cord in the socket, the outlet. And it was just a mess. And they did that on more than one occasion. We got that taken care of. And then on campus, when they said that you couldn't smoke within 50 yards from any campus building, some reverted to chewing tobacco. And we had some of the boys on one of the floors spit their chewing tobacco in the corners, in the hallway, or on the wall and whatnot. We called them the spitter boys. But we was able to take care of that. One of the students, he was one of the wrestlers. He was like a door with a head on top. And he's the only one that stepped up and claimed responsibility, but wouldn't give his friends up. And he cleaned everything up, but he made sure it never happened again. Because he wasn't going to do it a second time. And then the worst ones, I would say, was we called them the pee-pee boys. You ever hear about how boys have pissing contests?
Oh, boy.
Well, they had a pile of toilet paper in the restroom, and they must have been using that like a target. We wasn't getting anything moved on that one till one day the CD just happened to come up there, seen it for themselves. And the only student that was in there, she unhinged on him. And he kept saying, it's not me, I wasn't doing it. And she said, doesn't matter, if it happens again, everybody in the dorm gets kicked out. Everybody in that suite hall was going to get kicked out. Never happened again. So, yeah, we've had, and there's even more horror stories, you know, but I've been there 14 years. You're going to find some, a few horror stories. But for the very most part, I think that most of the students are polite, they're respectful, and, you know, they do the right thing. But you do have some that they're used to mommy and daddy, you know, cleaning up after them. I don't know how to put it. The UNC is only going to do but so much, you know, punishment to the students, because they need the students to be there. They don't want them to get frustrated to the point of rules and regulations and repercussions that they move off campus. And we see the feverish pitch that contractors and developers are doing in building apartments and stuff. You know, you got to get with the times. And I remember when I first got there in the Teague dormitory, I was shocked. I had a certain expectation. This is UNC Chapel Hill. It's known all over the world. And that's what I was looking at. It was clean and everything, but I had certain expectations as to what a, you know, something like that would look like. Well, back in the 1950s, when it was built, it was probably, you know, to the standards of what right. dormitories would look like. I heard parents, you know, because I said something to them, and they said, oh, you think this is bad. You should have seen the dormitories from such and such college that I had to be in. This is fancy. And so they're the one paying it, and they're the ones like, hey, this is luxurious compared to what I had to be in. So, but I'm glad that they are coming up to the realization that little by little, before COVID, it was in the works to approve knocking down the Teague and Parker dormitory and building a whole new building. So, yeah, they got it on their mind, but it's got to stay within budgets. And I don't know when things are going to get back to a norm after COVID and the hundreds of millions of dollars they lost.
Well, let's talk a little bit about COVID. I know that something some housekeepers were upset about was that it was difficult when the pandemic first started to get the supplies you needed. This was a time, like, let's remember that it was not easy to get masks and hand sanitizer and everything that now is kind of readily available. Can you talk about what it was like to be working on campus at that moment?
Well, I was definitely part of the group that, you know, protested to get things to be safe for the employees. And as far as there being a shortage of those things, as far as my point of view, I say BS, because it wasn't that they were trying to tighten those purse strings as tight as they possibly could. When I first came back, they wanted to give us only one of those paper face masks a week, wear the same mask for 5 days. And we had to protest that. So then that got changed where we got a mask for every day. And if something happened to it, we needed to have it replaced. Let's say I dropped it in my mop bucket and I needed to replace that one for that day. They would replace it, no problems. We asked for face shields. We had to push for that because some of the housekeepers, the situation they're in with the way they have to do their showers, sometimes water splashes onto their face. That mask is right against their nose and their mouth. And so we wanted to get face shields to protect them from anything that would splash back in their face and on their mask. And we got them to give us a whole box of the gloves to use that we wear whenever we're working. They did a lot of turnabout. The more we pushed, the more they was on the news, the more they bent. And so they really ended up getting with the program, but we had to fight. We had to push them and be on the news. At the beginning, it was like walking in a minefield blindfold with clown shoes on. Felt very dangerous.
So I want to just mention that you are part of UE 150, the North Carolina Service Workers Union, who was kind of behind a lot of protests. And there was also a really kind of amazing Facebook Live event where housekeepers across the university system and other people really spoke out about the challenges you were facing going to work, you know, in the summer when COVID was spreading so rapidly. I mean, another thing that you were upset about was not being informed of outbreaks on campus among students, COVID outbreaks. And I know that in the fall, UNC Chapel Hill had a lot of them. I mean, so many that within a few weeks, you know, everyone in the country, I think, probably knows that UNC Chapel Hill had to send everyone home. So I'm really wondering what it was like to be working in the dorms at that time when you knew that students were, and large numbers of them were, coming down with COVID.
Well, in the very beginning, when they wasn't telling us anything, that's when it was the most frightening. The dormitory that was right next to our main dormitory that we have our meetings and everything in had the football team there. And nobody knew that anybody came down with COVID until it came on the news. And yeah. And I went in, I know the housekeepers that was in there. And I asked my zone manager about it. And she didn't know anything about it. She calls our assistant director. He didn't know anything about it. And I told him, I didn't ask. I'm sorry. I'm just not that kind of girl. Sometimes I am, but this is a life or death situation. I told my boss and I told those housekeepers, they're not going in there. They're just not. We're not asking for permission. We're just letting you know. And that happened on more than one occasion. I don't go to the administrators to find out what I need to find out, because from the top down, they'll lie, you know, and hide different things. I went to the football players. I asked them. And they told me how many came down with it. They told me how they handled it and where they went to. And I made sure those people knew too. So that was scary. And then when they got caught too many times with all of that, then they came up with the Alert Carolina. They would let us know dormitories where there was an outbreak. An outbreak was, or a cluster was, five or more people that tested positive.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of the union UE 150, the North Carolina Service Workers Union, in these efforts that you were engaged in to get more protection? And also just, you know, how long have you been a member of the union? Why it's important? If you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Gosh, I've been with UE 150 for probably 10 years or more. And I would say that, how should I put, they're indispensable, absolutely indispensable. And they're made up of a lot of caring, courageous, community-minded individuals. We need to have more like them. We couldn't have gotten nowhere near a fraction of what we've accomplished over the years without them.
One of the major happenings at UNC Chapel Hill in the past few years was the student protest against Silent Sam, which is a huge statue of a Confederate soldier that was right at the entrance to the main quad. And in 2018, students surprised the administration and really the world by actually yanking the statue down. And you were there for that. Can you tell us about how you found out about the protest, why you attended? Tell us a little bit about that night.
Well, why I attended is we couldn't have accomplished anything ever without them. I mean, you get the students behind you, you got something right there. The university is going to listen to the students, especially if they yell loud enough and long enough. So sometimes you have to do the wrong thing to get the right thing done. So I've always been proud of the students. But I don't think I was ever more proud. I was never more proud of them than that night. Because they really stepped up, put everything on the line to do the right thing. And then Carolyn Folt, our chancellor, seeing that they was not going to do the right thing in the long run, and she made sure she put everything on the line. And she got that pedestal out of there. Cost her her job, but she ended up landing on her feet. Real good job in California. Somebody appreciated her. I was just real proud, real proud.
We were all surprised by the statue coming down. Did you know that was going to happen when you showed up that evening?
No, I didn't. And I, as soon as they put up those poles with that tarp thing and was putting it around the statue, I knew exactly what was going to happen. It was just a moment of, it was so exciting. It was so exciting to feel like finally, after all these years and years, something, it was like, this is the moment. You knew this was going to be a changing moment in history. And to be a part of that was just so exciting. I don't even know if I can put into words how exuberant that it was. And it was just like electricity in the air. There was no stopping it. And it was just great. One of the best things ever. And I protested in Washington, D.C. And this Silent Sam is the finest moment I will always remember. It will always be top on the list because of the individuals, because of the cause, the feeling and the electricity in the air. It was just unforgettable.
Are there any common misconceptions about your job, the students, or college in general that you hear a lot and you know, think that maybe listeners of College Land might also believe, and that you now would be a good time to, you know, kind of correct the record?
The biggest misconception is that the kids that go to college are a bunch of spoiled rich kids, and that is so untrue. Only, I believe, 1% of the students that go to UNC has family that can just write a check. There are students there that are, you know, privileged to, you know, nice ways of life and stuff like that. But we got a housekeeper that put two kids through college at UNC. Mm-hmm. So, no, there are a lot of students, you know, that they got to understand that going to school is their job. That's what their job is. And on top of all of that, they got to have other jobs to help sustain themselves.
On weekends, you volunteer at local food banks.
Yeah.
I think that really speaks to you being at the Silent Sam protest. I mean, just the whole part, you know. And so you said, you know, the students show up for the housekeepers when you need things, and you showed up for the students. And now also on the weekends, you're, you know, out there volunteering at a local food bank. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how long have you been doing this work?
Gosh, let me see. I've been part of one thing or another since forever. I grew up that way. It's just part of my nature, I guess. You know, you got to show, you got a voice. Nothing's going to change if you don't do something. How do they say evil only flourishes when good men stand aside and say and do nothing? So that's why I get out there and do the protesting and everything, because that's how we, you know, get things done. We got to show our voice, and we can't shrink away from it and our responsibility to ourselves, our community, to our country.
Tracy Harder, thank you for all you've done for our students, for all you do for the campus at large, and thanks for visiting College Land.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed myself very much, and I hope you'll feel free to call upon me at any other given time.
Thank you, Tracy.
I love this interview, Lisa. What really stands out to me is the care that Tracy gives to the students. The care work that is part of so many service jobs is so under-recognized. I mean, many of these students that Tracy talks to are living away from home for the first time. They're away from parental figures. And the care that she gives to them is really a service to the university that she's providing.
It's such an unrecognized and uncompensated element of the job, really, when you think about it. She's probably saving them from writing frantic emails home, all kinds of things, right, that she's doing to enhance the life of the university.
Right. And, you know, service staff are also there for faculty. You know, when I was a brand new professor, I was in a really difficult time in my life. You know, I was basically in crisis. And one of my faculty colleagues saw it and checked in on me a lot. But most of my faculty colleagues did not notice at all that anything was going on with me. But Mr. David Brown, the janitor, was the person who got me through that time. He talked to me every day. He'd come by my office. He made me laugh. He had wisdom to share. He saw me as a whole person, and I was brand new in the university and the city, you know? So that was just amazing for me. And it wasn't just me. He talked to so many people in the hallway. And, you know, a couple years later, I asked him about it. And he said that basically he saw that part of the job as his calling. The cleaning was on the side. You know, he saw us professors as sad and lonely people who needed him, which, you know, yeah, and I'll just leave that there about whether that's true or not. But, you know, I'll always be grateful for the kindness that he showed me. And it's part of why I'm still a professor.
That's so moving. I was really also so moved by Tracy attending and being moved by the student protests of Silent Sam.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, it's like, why have I never thought about this? Housekeepers, cafeteria workers, carpenters, electricians, groundkeepers, so many kinds of workers have an investment in the place where they work every single day. They literally keep it going. But they're not considered when there are major controversies around racism on campus, for example, as there have been on almost every campus recently. So I think we need to remember that they are, you know, stakeholders, one of my least favorite words, you know.
I totally agree.
What do we say though? You know, like they belong, right? Yep. They belong in campus life. They're members of campus life.
And they and have of course a stake they care. In it. Yeah.
So I won't forget Tracy's description of that event.
She really brought me back to just what it's like to be in a dorm, right? And how they shape the experience of life on a campus. And when I went to college, living in a crappy dorm, I mean, it just felt like par for the course. It was a rite of passage almost. I still remember my great uncle in my first year came to visit. And I remember he, you know, it was like this excitement. He was going to come and see me at college. And he showed up and my parents were there too that day. It was one of those visiting days, right? And he showed up and he like came into the dorm room and he looked around and his eyes, I mean, it was like he was horrified at the conditions in which I was living, the cinder block. I mean, it was pretty bleak. And I remember he just looked at my parents and he said, "You're paying for this?" Like it was such a moment because I had gotten used to it by that time. It was a few months in. But today it is interesting to think about the fact that so many institutions are actually spending a lot of money to upgrade and construct fancy new dorms to attract students and also to keep athletes, I think, is also a big part of that. And I think the reason that they're doing this is partly because we've created this terrible system where universities are all competing for the same students and their funding is tied to enrollments. Also, as Tracy pointed out, they're reacting to increasing competition from private developers who build kind of dorm-like accommodations right near campus. And we're going to be talking more in future episodes about this whole issue of private dorms. It's much more interesting than you might think.
Yeah, I love that we have to find the explanation for why dorm life has improved. It's not because those conditions were horrible. And actually, they still are in very many places. I know in my dorm, I was in a dorm room that was made for two people, but there were three of us in there. And one of my freshman roommates brought like 40 stuffed animals. And her stuffed animals were everywhere. We had a sink in our room. There was usually a stuffed animal in the sink. They were in the trash can. God. They were on my bed. They were on my other roommate's bed. They were everywhere. Yeah, it was a year. And like, yeah, but I don't remember any spitter boys or pee boys in my dorm. So I'm thankful for that.
Tracy was so funny talking about the occasional disgusting aspects of student dorm life, but she still loved the students. And was really interesting that when I asked her about myths, she focused on what's now really becoming a theme of college land, that stereotypes of campuses and students as elite are just really wrong.
And now it's time for Extra Credit, in which we highlight cool things for our listeners to check out. And this week, if you check them all out, we'll give you the College Land Extra Mile Award.
Right. It comes with like a little paper certificate that you can hang up in your dorm room or wherever that might be. So my first extra credit follows on the theme of housekeepers, and I'm going to recommend one of the many amazing books that have been written on housekeepers who work in other people's homes. I read it many years ago, but it really still sticks with me. It's by Pierrette Hondagno-Sotella, and it's called Domestica: Immigrant Workers Cleaning and Caring in the Shadow of Affluence. And it was published by University of California Press in 2007. It's based on extensive interviews with Mexican and Central American women who work as housekeepers in Los Angeles, caring for other people's children and their homes. And you get a real sense of the critical importance of their work and the sacrifices that they make. Many left their own children in their home country so they could earn a living by caring for other people's children in the U.S. And they send that money back to their homes, to their children.
That sounds great. I want to read that. Well, my extra credit offering is a 13-minute documentary on YouTube called Justice for Janitors, a story of hope, courage, and triumph. And we'll put the link to that in show notes, but you can just Google it too. So this short documentary was made in 2014, and it tells the really dramatic story of a union movement of janitors in 1990 using loads of really amazing footage. And the Justice for Janitors effort started among janitors in California that worked in these high-powered office buildings and that housed, you know, really wealthy companies, but the janitors still, you know, earned terrible wages. So the film shows like these dramatic moments when police attacked protesting janitors in Los Angeles. There's footage of that. It's actually very much an echo of what's going on today. And then the movement spread to university workers. So janitors at the University of Miami went on a hunger strike after long efforts to get union recognition had failed by other means. There's so much drama packed into 13 minutes. I really enjoyed watching it.
That sounds amazing. I've heard of the Justice for Janitors campaign, but I've never seen any of that footage. So I'm definitely going to check it out. And listeners, you can also get a final piece of extra credit by following the Twitter account of Aijian Pu, the executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And we'll put the link to the Twitter account in the show notes. Aijian's Twitter will keep you up to date on what's happening with housekeepers, domestic workers, home health care workers, child care workers, and more. And the latest struggle is over Biden's infrastructure proposals. Aijian and her allies have been making the argument that child care and home care are important forms of infrastructure. They're services that everyone benefits from and that are necessary for the functioning of our economy. And so you can follow this ongoing debate and more at Aijian Pu. And while you're at it, follow us on Twitter at CollegeLandPod.
And if you like what you've heard today, we hope you'll subscribe to CollegeLand on your favorite podcast app and give us some stars, leave us a review. And please send us feedback and episode suggestions or even your gross dorm stories by email, collegelandpod@gmail.com. And that's it for CollegeLand. Thanks to our wonderful producer, Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support.
See you next time on CollegeLand.